From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was only 174 seconds when the blue sky blackened and David Barron witnessed a total solar eclipse in 1998. Barron is a science journalist, and he knew what to expect, but he says he had no idea he would have such a personal reaction. And those of you driving up north to see the eclipse on Monday, you should know this may be an emotional experience. Barron says he felt transported to another planet when the sky darkened. In his new book, he tells the stories of some of the people who went chasing after another eclipse. These were scientists who came to the American West in 1878. David Barron is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called American Eclipse. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Barron says for those of you traveling up north next Monday to be in the path of the total solar eclipse, be prepared to have your mind blown. And maybe you're rolling your eyes like, sure, it's going to be cool, but come on, 2 minutes of darkness is great, but life-changing? Well, actually, seeing a solar eclipse kind of was for Barron, who's a science journalist, used to be an environment correspondent for NPR. Seeing the eclipse, he says, turned him into an umbrophile. That's what they call eclipse chasers. Barron has a book out about one particular eclipse in 1878, and like Monday, the path of totality for that eclipse was here in the American West. It's about how American scientists came here to the West to see and explore this phenomenon and hopefully put America on the map. The book is called American Eclipse. David Barron joined us from the public radio station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. That's where he lives. And we began, of course, with his first eclipse.
Actually, at the time, I was a science correspondent for NPR, and in 1994 did a story about a partial solar eclipse that crossed the country. And in the course of my reporting, I interviewed an astronomer who explained to me that as interesting as a partial solar eclipse is, a total solar eclipse, which is much rarer, he explained, was the most awe-inspiring sight in all of nature. And he said the following to me, this guy I'd never met before. He said, you know, before you die, you owe it to yourself to experience a total solar eclipse. And that stuck with me. And so I learned that in February 1998, a total eclipse would cross Aruba. And I thought, well, I was going to go see what he was talking about.
It's interesting. You say you figured you knew what to expect, but that the experience itself really exceeded your expectations. And it was, I'm so interested in how, I have to say, kind of personal your reaction was, because you describe it as intense.
Oh, more than intense. It was, I mean, the best word I can use is spiritual. And you're talking to someone who is not a traditionally religious person. So I knew what to expect in terms of what would happen. It would get dark. Yeah. Bright stars and planets would come out. I would see a sun I'd never seen before, where you can actually, during the total eclipse, you can look with your naked eye and see the sun's outer atmosphere. But the effect it had on me was as if I suddenly saw truth. I just suddenly understood where I exist in the universe and how puny I am and at the mercy of these enormous forces, but that I am part of something enormous and grand. It was both tremendously humbling and incredibly empowering at the same time. It really is I'm doing my best, but I tell you, it's an inexplicable experience.
A visceral connection to the universe.
Absolutely.
Say. And you say it's life-changing.
It was for me and for a lot of people I know who've seen total eclipses. And I mean, there are very few Americans who have seen total eclipses because it's been 38 years since a total eclipse last touched the continental United States. But There are other folks like me who are eclipse chasers and who will go out of our way to go around the world to have this experience. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people who are eclipse chasers, and obviously we are the more zealous folks. But in the course of my book tour over the last 2 months, I've had a lot of people come up to me, mostly elderly people, who back in the 60s or 50s saw a total eclipse in the United States. And they describe it to me decades later with this vividness and this sense of emotion about how even after all these years, it remains one of the most significant experiences in their life.
We'll come back to this, but you also say in the book that you see eclipses as a way to connect the present with the past. Say something about that.
Yeah, well, it's a couple of things. One is eclipses are, at any given point on Earth, they are extraordinarily rare. I mean, so again, it's been 38 years since the United States, the continental United States, has seen one. They recur over such a long time span that you have to think back. Well, the last time a total eclipse crossed the United States coast to coast was 1918. Mm. So we start to think about, well, what was life like for those people? But more significantly, what I mean by that is that a total eclipse really is the same human experience today as it was certainly back in the 1800s. And when you see one, you think about, well, what did ancient people think when they had that same view of the heavens? It makes you think about the future, too, because we can look forward and, you know, 100, 200 years from now, when the next total eclipses will be, and imagine what the people, assuming they're still around, what the experience will be like for them.
Talk about how you came up with the idea for the book, because if I read this right, it seems like at first you figured you wanted to explore how humans were going to respond to this experience. Like that's what it was about. But it seems to have kind of taken a turn as you start to read these experiences, and eventually it becomes a book about how essentially this is how you put it, how the United States becomes the nation it is today, the experience of seeing an eclipse in 1878.
So this book is the result of a long journey that goes back 19 years. I mean, it was when I saw my first total eclipse in Aruba in 1998 and was blown away by it. I thought, as a science writer, I'm going to write a book about eclipse chasing. But I knew even back then that, frankly, the time to come out with the book would be the summer of 2017, because this was when I knew Americans would actually want to learn about eclipses. So I put the project on hold for a while. And about 7-8 years ago, I thought, well, if I'm serious about that book, I better figure out what it's going to be about. And I wanted to tell a good story. I wanted to find an eclipse story that was worthy of a book. And it didn't take long to discover that the best eclipse stories are not from today. They're from the 19th century, because that's when total eclipses were very important to science, when astronomers used total eclipses as these rare and precious events that they could use to study the sun in a way that they could do at no other time. And so I started to look at various total eclipses at that time. And whenever a total eclipse would occur, there would be these expeditions that would go off, astronomers would set up their equipment in the path of the moon's shadow, and then frantically conduct their experiments in 2 or 3 minutes of midday darkness. So I looked at the eclipse of 1868 that crossed India and Siam, and I looked at the eclipse of 1870 that crossed the Mediterranean. And each of these eclipses has interesting characters and interesting science that was done. But when I came to the eclipse of 1878, which crossed the American West, the Wild West, it just all fell together, the characters and, as you say, the significance of it, because it occurred at a time when the United States did not have much of a reputation, and that's putting it mildly, in the sciences. We were looked down upon by the Europeans as in terms of our intellect. And this was America's chance to show Europe that we could do science. This was our eclipse. And so it really was an important event that the American public rallied around that eventually helped lead us to become the global superpower in science.
Let's talk about some of the basics for this eclipse that's coming up next Monday. There are partial solar eclipses that happen at least, you say, twice a year in various places around the world. Those are kind of subtle. There are lunar eclipses, not terribly rare. Explain what is so unique about a total solar eclipse, and because that is different. And I mean beyond the obvious differences. You say this really is a singular experience. And in fact, here's what you write. You say a total eclipse pulls back the curtain that is the daytime sky. So how is this singular as an experience to behold?
Right. So next Monday, all of North America will experience at least a partial eclipse. And yeah. So in Salt Lake City, it'll be more than a 90% partial eclipse. And so that means if you look at the sun safely, and I stress safely, if you get yourself some safe eclipse glasses, don't look at the sun with the naked eye, you will see the sun turn into a crescent. And that's what people all across North America will see. And that will be interesting. But the only way to observe it will be by some indirect means, that is either through very, very dark eclipse glasses or using a pinhole projector. Take a piece of cardboard, punch a hole in it, and let the sunlight fall through it. You don't look through it, and you'll see a little crescent projected onto another surface. That's very interesting, but that is fundamentally different from what the experience will be like if you're in the 70-mile-wide path of totality that goes from Oregon to South Carolina, because in that path, the eclipse will begin as a partial eclipse, and it will continue for about an hour and a quarter or hour and a half as a partial eclipse. But as soon as the moon completely obscures the face of the sun, it's as if you've been transported to another planet. It suddenly goes dark, and not dark like midnight, but dark like twilight. And that is the only time when you can safely and should take off your eclipse glasses and look up in the sky with the naked eye. And what you are actually looking at is a view you can have at no other time. You are looking into space, not away from the sun, which of course is what the nighttime sky is, but you're looking into space toward the sun. You're looking at the inner solar system, and you can see the sun with your naked eye, which is this beautiful wreath-like object. It's the solar corona. It's just the most glorious thing you've ever seen. It has these filaments that shimmer like pieces of tinsel, yeah. And the shape is different every time. It's shaped by the sun's magnetic field. But you can see the sun and the planets together. It's as if you are on some planet outside our solar system looking back, or like you're looking at a diagram in a high school textbook. Oh, here's what the solar system looks like. There's the sun in the middle, and there are the planets. And you're seeing it with the naked eye.
How long does it last?
It's so brief.
Yeah.
It's a total solar eclipse can never last more than about 7.5 minutes, and that's a really long one. Usually just 2 or 3 minutes, and this year, the longest it will be is 2 minutes, 41 seconds,
wow.
And that's in southern Illinois. In our part of the country here in the West, it'll be closer to 2, 2.25 minutes at the maximum.
You say in the Faroe Islands, for example, so there's this experience of seeing this corona, and you write about this. You say you could see the corona for a full 2 seconds?
Well, so that was in 2015.
Yeah.
I went to the Faroe Islands, which are up in the North Atlantic near Iceland, and that was one of only two places that the moon's shadow, two places in terms of land, that the moon's shadow would cross that year. So we didn't have many options in terms of where to go. The Faroe Islands are notoriously stormy. And so during the total eclipse, which lasted, I think, about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, it was mostly clouded out. But luckily, a hole opened up in the clouds for a full 2 seconds that I got to see the solar corona. And I counted myself lucky. I wasn't, frankly, expecting I'd get to see it at all that year.
It's David Barron. His book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. If you have any questions left about the eclipse on Monday morning, we'll put a few links on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about solar eclipses with the science journalist David Barron. Barron's new book is about one eclipse in particular in 1878 and the American scientists who raced to the American West to see it. It's called American Eclipse. I want to talk about this experience in Texas. We'll come back to the West later in the program, too, but I want to talk about this moment in Texas. This, of course, is July 29th, 1878. And in Texas, there had been this really strange weather, a particularly brutal winter in some parts of the country. In Texas, it was freezing cold. It was weird. There had been a plague of grasshoppers that year. Now, forgive a dumb question, but do eclipse years come with strange occurrences like that?
No. Yeah. No. So, I mean, an eclipse year is just like any other year. But, of course, you know, if you roll the dice long enough, you'll come up with two sixes. So occasionally an right. eclipse will occur at the same time as a plague of grasshoppers.
July 28th, 1878. You say it was an unremarkable day in Texas at first, scattered clouds. But then I love how you describe what happens as the eclipse begins. Croaking frogs, bats flying in the afternoon, fireflies start to glow, birds stop singing. You write this, the air stopped moving. And this is the important part, at least for this part of the story, fear, you say, swept over the fields. Talk about this experience in Texas.
Well, so interestingly, in 1878, the vast majority of Americans knew that the eclipse was coming. Scientists were able to predict it well in advance. They knew precisely to within a few miles where the path of the total eclipse would fall from Montana territory down to Texas. And so anyone who read the newspapers knew that it was coming. And in Wyoming and in Colorado, as far as I can tell, everyone knew it was coming. They were excited about it. But a significant portion of the population in Texas had not gotten word.
Yeah.
And folks were out in their fields on what they thought was a typical July afternoon when all of a sudden things get very strange. It starts to get dark. And as you said, bats come out and fireflies. And then all of a sudden they're plunged into darkness. And not only that, but they look up in the sky, and instead of seeing the sun, they see this beautiful crown in space. Well, in this part of Texas where a lot of people were devout, they were absolutely convinced that this was Jesus returning.
Yeah.
And it was Judgment Day. So you can imagine, I mean, they fell to their knees in prayer. They ran to church. And unfortunately, there was one tragedy that yeah. was provoked by it as well.
Tell that story. This is Ephraim Miller.
Yeah. So he was out in his field when all of a sudden he's plunged into darkness, and he thought Judgment Day was coming anyway. In fact, he was quoted as saying he had reason to believe it was coming that night. Well, sure enough, here it was. So he, in the darkness of the total eclipse, runs home, grabs a hatchet. He seems to have decided he was not going to stick around for the apocalypse. He wanted to get to the other side quickly. Mm-hmm. And tragically, he found his young son, about 10 years old. He killed him with a hatchet. And then Ephraim himself took a razor, sliced his own neck. So this was 1878. I mean, this is not ancient times. Yeah. And yet this was the reaction.
You say that what we see in an eclipse reflects our own longings and fears. I guess that was particularly true here.
Yeah, I mean, I think even today there will be a sense, it's going to depend on the individual, about whether you see it as a religious experience. Some people really will feel like they're having an encounter with God. Other people will see it as more of a scientific experience. Some will find it uplifting. Others will find it terrifying. I mean, I tell you, there is an aspect of terror to a total eclipse, even when you know exactly what's going on. For the sun to disappear in the middle of the day, it is horrifying.
I just wanted to ask, get a sense of, if we go back centuries, hundreds, thousands of years, what did you learn about the way people reacted to eclipses. You mention two warring powers, for example, in the 6th century. They looked up, saw this eclipse, and basically stopped fighting. And I mean, how were people anciently dealing with this phenomenon?
Well, in various ways, right. So that that eclipse you're mentioning is it, a number of historians believe it occurred in 585 BC because, in fact, there was a total eclipse that crossed that part of Asia that year that fits with what Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, says in terms of these two warring powers stopping their war when it suddenly went dark. But we know that in China in ancient times, people believed that it was a dragon devouring the sun, and they would beat pots and pans and gongs to try to scare the dragon off. And in medieval times in Europe, it was an eclipse of any sort, lunar or solar, total or partial, was often seen as a bad omen for the king. And in fact, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy in 840 AD when the Holy Roman Emperor Louis the Pious, a total solar eclipse crossed over France. And he was so anxious that it meant that it did not portend well for him that reports are he stopped eating. And he, in fact, died a month later. And that plunged Europe into civil war. So total eclipses have, in fact, changed history. Mm.
All right, let's fast forward to 1878. We'll come back here. Give us a setting for what's going on in the country as you do. In the book, General Custer had recently been killed in the Little Bighorn, and this is 1876, and you take us to Philadelphia. Give us a sense, what's going on in the country? We're industrializing, we're urbanizing, things are changing.
Right. So, yeah, I opened the book in 1876 in Philadelphia, where the U.S. was celebrating its centennial at the big Centennial Exhibition. And it was really a chance for America. America was feeling like it was finally coming of age. This democracy was now 100 years old, and we were starting to mature. We were the Civil War was over.
Yeah.
We were now a unified country again, and we were rapidly industrializing. We were laying railroads and telegraph lines, and life was changing, and people were getting wealthier, and we were really starting to come into our own. And so that is the framework for what was happening in the country. But where we lacked, as I said earlier, was this respect from Europe in terms of our intellect. Europe was the clear center of Western culture. That's where respectable literature and art and music and science came from. And there was this hardy band of American scientists at that time who were determined to turn the United States into a true scientific power. What they needed was something to get the American people excited about science. Yeah. And it just so happened that they had that come along 2 years later in 1878.
It was a time, you say, when we had a lot of money, but the rest of the world didn't think we had substance. It was the reign of shoddy. Was the
right.
description, right?
Well, and in fact, so that was one way of describing the era. But of course, we often call it the Gilded Age.
Right.
But what people don't realize is that was meant as an insult.
Yeah.
The term was invented by Mark Twain. And he meant it that we thought of ourselves as this beautiful, shiny thing. But, you know, what we were gilded, it was just this thin layer of gold on a worthless interior. And that was how Europe looked at us. Okay, we had money, but we had no substance. And that's what we had to show the world. We had substance, too.
At what point, David Baron, do astronomers, at what point are astronomers able to really predict with some accuracy when an eclipse is coming?
So there are two answers to that question. Actually, you can go back to ancient times. The Chinese, the Babylonians, the Mayans, they understood, even though they didn't know what caused eclipses, they understood that they repeated themselves in a specific pattern. So in fact, both solar and lunar eclipses recur on an about an 18-year cycle. It's actually 18 years, 11 and a third days. A given eclipse will come back. It won't visit the same part of the planet, but it will come back. And so this pattern was figured out by many ancient civilizations. But the ability to actually map the path of a total eclipse requires a sophisticated understanding of orbital mechanics and of mathematics, and that didn't come along really until the 18th century. And Edmund Halley, who's known today as the man who figured out that a comet, now known as Halley's Comet, comes back on a regular basis, he was an early eclipse mapper. And he so after that was in the early 1700s, after Halley, astronomers got pretty good at coming up with these very detailed maps.
So there's this report in the journal Nature. Astronomers had made this calculation. There's going to be a total solar eclipse in the western United States, as you said. This is set for July 29th, 1878. And in some ways, this brings up one of the characters in the book, Simon Newcomb. He's a mathematical astronomer. And Newcomb, you say, is in some ways kind of responsible for the eclipse, you know, alerting the public, charting its course, talking about the duration. Talk a little bit about Newcomb, because he basically is starting to tell everyone this is where this thing is going to happen.
Right. So Simon Newcomb was an incredibly influential man in science in the United States back then. And he really he lobbied the government for more funding of science, and he helped establish various scientific institutions. In 1878, he was the head of the Nautical Almanac Office, which was part of the Navy, and published an annual almanac that basically was just had charts and charts filled with numbers that would tell navigators at sea where they could find various heavenly objects on any given day of the year. And that's what navigators would use to navigate. In order to create the Nautical Almanac, you needed to actually calculate the orbits of planets several years into the future. And this was Newcomb's job. He headed the Nautical Almanac Office. And as part of that job, it was the Nautical Almanac Office's responsibility to chart the path of the eclipse. And so he really was pushing for educating the public about what was coming and also trying to get the government to fund eclipse expeditions out to the west, to have astronomers from the east bring their telescopes, get onto trains, and head out to the path of the total eclipse to conduct astrophysical studies.
It didn't seem like the U.S. had much of a plan.
No, it didn't.
Right? I mean, they're trying to bolster their reputation. And they didn't really have a plan.
Well, it's the politicians didn't have a plan.
Exactly.
The astronomers were looking forward to this for quite some time. They had to convince Congress to come up with the money. And so the eclipse, again, was occurring July 29th. And in March, the House of Representatives took up a funding bill where they were being encouraged to throw in $8,000 to fund eclipse expeditions to the west, and they declined to fund it. This was only a few months before the eclipse, and then it went off to the Senate. And at that point, the astronomers got in touch with the newspapers, and the newspapers shamed Congress into actually coming up with the money. So it wasn't until late April or early May, just a couple of 3 months before the eclipse, that the funding came through. And then they had to frantically throw together these expeditions.
Isn't this always the case? I'm thinking about the current battles between NASA and Congress, for example. It seems like this is an ongoing thing in the United States.
I don't think it's any different.
So in 1878, you mentioned Newcomb is saying, all right, this we have an opportunity here. Scientists have an opportunity. And you say for Newcomb and others, they really figured they were trying to unravel the enigma of the sun itself. That's the thing they figured they were going to learn in 1878. Explain what you mean by that, what they meant by that, the enigma of the sun.
Well, put yourself back in the early or mid-19th century. This is before we knew anything about nuclear fusion. Yeah. All we know is there's this big thing in the sky that's really hot and really bright. what is it? What is it made of? Where does all that fuel come from? And it was a great mystery. There were all these theories about what made the sun shine. In fact, one theory was that maybe there's material raining in from space, a constant rain of meteors, and as it comes in, that's what we're seeing. They really didn't know. But a total eclipse offers just a precious opportunity to conduct studies, because normally you have a really hard time studying the sun because it is so bright. All you can see through a telescope, if you use your filters, is the bright surface of the sun. But during a total eclipse, when the moon slips right in front of the sun and covers up the bright surface, it gives you an opportunity to look at what's right around the sun. And so they knew back then that during a total eclipse, this mysterious thing called the corona appeared. They didn't know what it was. So in fact, there was a period when it was thought perhaps it actually was the atmosphere of the moon that was backlit by the sun during a total eclipse. But later they figured out it probably was part of the sun, but it didn't seem to be an atmosphere in any normal sense. So during an eclipse, they could look at it. They could use not only their telescopes, but spectroscopes that enabled scientists to try to figure out what chemical elements were in the corona and to conduct some other studies. But you only had maybe 3 minutes every year and a half somewhere on the planet. So it was a lot of work for just a few precious minutes of study.
You know what I liked about the book a lot, too, is that the West, you know, the Intermountain West, the West of the United States, is a character in this story.
And a more interesting character than I thought, frankly,
really?
Going into this. Well, you know, I live in Colorado, yeah. Although I grew up in New England. But, you know, we all grew up on stories of the Wild West. And some of it's true. I mean, there really were train robberies going on. And the train that Edison took out to Wyoming was robbed a few weeks before he was on it. And, you know, things were pretty rough. But what surprised me was the extent to which the pioneers who lived in Wyoming and Colorado were really excited about science. I thought they would just, all they cared about was mining the land and ranching and, you know, and just settling. But when these astronomers showed up, the residents were really keen to look through the telescopes. And they volunteered to help with the studies of the eclipse as well. So there was tremendous excitement about the eclipse as a scientific event in the Wild West.
It's David Barron. His book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. We'll take another break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with science journalist David Barron. We're talking about his new book, American Eclipse. So coursing throughout this book are the stories of three terrific characters in particular. A lot of characters, actually, but you really focus on three in particular. And I want to talk about these people. They're great. Thomas Edison, of course. And they all end up in Philadelphia at some point in 1876, which is kind of interesting. Let's talk about Thomas Edison first. He's 29 at the time in 1876, just starting to receive some fame. He wasn't exactly a celebrity, but people knew who he was. And there's this myth about Edison. That he kind of promoted, you say, that he wasn't a deep intellectual. He was just this hardworking and persistent tinkerer. He himself sort of later in his life anyway said that. But you said the truth is, in fact, that Edison, and especially Edison, who's 29 and 31 when the eclipse comes, very much aspired to be thought of as a scientist. Talk about Edison's role here.
Yeah, so Thomas Edison, the young Thomas Edison, In 1876, one of his best-known inventions was called the electric pen.
Yeah.
And it basically was a mimeograph device. You could use this pen, which actually poked little holes in a piece of paper, to create a stencil that you would then use to make a whole bunch of copies of correspondence, for instance. So he was not yet known as some great, brilliant man, but he was a successful inventor. But he did, in fact, aspire to be a true scientist. He, in 1875, thought that he had discovered a new fundamental force of nature, like electricity or magnetism or gravity. And he called it the etheric force. And he announced it to the newspapers and for a short time got a lot of positive attention, but then very quickly the scientific community discounted it as ridiculous, and he was really ridiculed for it. And so by the time of the 1878 eclipse, where he now was a much more famous inventor, because by 1878 he invented the phonograph, mm-hmm. which is what really launched him to stardom, he still wanted to be respected as a scientist. And so that's where the eclipse fits in for Edison, that Edison, who, as you say, later in life was quite adamant that he was an inventor, not a scientist. The young Thomas Edison wanted to be a scientist, and so he went out west to actually do some astronomical studies during the eclipse of 1878.
Yeah, he needed something to prove himself, I guess.
Right, yeah, and he, in fact, came up with a new device for astronomy.
Yeah.
It was something called the tizimeter, which was an extremely sensitive heat detector that he was going to use during the eclipse to study the solar corona, that mysterious aura around the eclipsed sun, to see if it gave off heat as well as light.
Say something about the tizimeter. He's trying to measure how much energy is given off by that corona, basically. And the stakes are pretty high here. You say he stakes his reputation on this device.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he... And this is typical of Edison. He was a very enthusiastic fellow and very self-confident. He announced, he went to the newspapers, just as he did with the etheric force, and announced his tizimeter, this brilliant new device that was going to transform astronomy, before he ever built the thing.
Right.
But he had the idea for it. And so once he told the newspapers how brilliant it was, he then had to actually create it, and he didn't get it finished until 2 days before he left for Wyoming for the eclipse. And so by the time he came out, he really didn't know if it was going to work during the eclipse.
Well, talking about a really powerful personality, let's talk about another one, James Craig Watson. He was a professor of astronomy in Michigan, and here's how you describe him. You say he was a lot like men of that era, innately competitive, craving wealth, shunning scruples.
Yeah, I absolutely loved spending time with Edison writing this book. I have to say, James Craig Watson,
not so
was
much.
A little harder to get along with. Yeah. Well, he had an enormous ego,
yeah.
And did not treat other people very well, especially his wife. But he was a very smart man. He was a child prodigy. He became a professor at the University of Michigan in his early 20s. And he was highly respected as, in that era, as a planet hunter. His great skill was in finding asteroids, which back in that era were considered planets. They were called minor planets, mm-hmm. but they were given names just like the major planets, and finding them was a very big deal. And Watson was one of the top planet hunters in the world. In fact, he was in a race with another American astronomer to have that title. And he you could just tell what he wanted more than anything out of the eclipse of 1878 was fame and respect.
So for years, the astronomical community had debated and explored this possibility that there was another planet circling the sun. This was within the orbit of Mercury, called Vulcan. And Watson is a believer.
Right. Yeah. So there were good reasons to believe that Vulcan existed. Mercury's orbit, when you do the math with Newtonian mechanics, Mercury's orbit did not quite match what the equation said it should be. And so astronomers, the best they could come up with was something was perturbing Mercury's orbit, and it was probably a planet, maybe several, between Mercury and the Sun that were tugging on Mercury. And so they came up with this hypothetical planet. They called it Vulcan. They knew it would be very hard to spot. It was so close to the Sun, it would never be in the sky at night, and you couldn't see it in the daytime in the Sun's glare. But during a total solar eclipse, when the Moon blocks the bright surface of the Sun, you might actually see Vulcan. Well, who was in a better position to find Vulcan than James Craig Watson, the great planet hunter? And he, in fact, announced before coming out to Wyoming in 1878 that his goal during those 3 minutes of midday darkness was to find Vulcan.
Hmm. Let's talk about Mariah Mitchell now. October of 1876, she's also in Philadelphia. There's a symposium going on called the Woman's Congress. And we meet her in your book when she gives this speech, where she says that the opportunities for women to study science at that time, meager and unsatisfactory. Talk about Mariah Mitchell.
Oh, she was so far ahead of her time. Yeah, in 1876, she gives a lecture called The Need of Women in Science. And she made the argument that science needs women and women need science.
Yeah.
That the doors of science should be open to women, that women, I mean, she was, you know, as I think she had to do in that era, she wasn't arguing that women and men are the same, but she was arguing that women bring their own sets of skills to science and that science is good for women. And so she really, her life's goal was to open the doors of science to women. And she was by far the most famous female scientist in America in that era. She was an astronomer. She rose to fame in 1847 when she discovered a comet, mm-hmm. and was awarded a gold medal from the King of Denmark. And so by the 1870s, she was teaching at Vassar College, the all-women's college, and really trying in her latter years to make things easier for the next generation of women.
Which it's an uphill climb, as you point out. I mean, the way everyone else saw women in the sciences, or really in general, that, you know, if they got higher educations, that would drop their maternal instincts, that it would give them, as someone put, an Amazonian coarseness and force if they got, you know, higher educations or if they studied the sciences. So there was Mariah Mitchell and these women had a lot to contend with, I guess.
Absolutely. No, and it wasn't just someone who said that. It was a Harvard doctor,
yeah.
who named Edward H. Clarke, who in 1873 came out with a book that made the claim, and it was taken seriously, that higher education could ruin a girl's health, that if a girl used her brain too much, it would sap resources from her reproductive organs and turn her into a sterile masculine invalid. And this is what Mariah Mitchell was up against,
yeah.
was this belief that that women should not get too much education.
I loved her as a character. It sounds like she was a terrific teacher. She said that science was best taught outside of the classroom. She didn't coddle her students. She must have been great. I'm trying to imagine what she was like to learn.
She
from.
Just seemed like a very straightforward, no-nonsense person. You know, and she just she didn't seem to care what other people thought or what society said about what was appropriate. She did what she thought was important and best.
And of course, her connection to the 1878 eclipse is that she conceives of this expedition of women to go west and study the eclipse.
At a time when, so as we discussed, Congress came up with $8,000 to send astronomers to the west. And the U.S. Naval Observatory sent out invitations to various universities asking for professors and students, did they want to come west and help with the eclipse expeditions? Vassar was left off the list. Mariah Mitchell and her students were not invited. So she took it upon herself to create her own eclipse expedition, six women on their own, headed out to Denver in 1878 to study the solar eclipse.
So how does it play out? High stakes for the three characters you mention. doesn't really amount to much, at least for certainly for Watson and Edison. Did we get much science out of it? Did it? You know, there was a lot at stake there. Did it amount to much? I guess is the question.
Well, so in the immediate aftermath of the eclipse, it was thought that both Edison and Watson had showed great success. Watson said that he found Vulcan. He found the hypothetical planet between Mercury and the Sun. Edison claimed that his tizimeter found heat in the solar corona, and in fact, he had grand ideas for using the tizimeter to just revolutionize astronomy. And both Watson and Edison got a lot of favorable press. Now, in hindsight, of course, Watson was wrong. There is no Vulcan. And in fact, he died 2 years later in a desperate attempt to prove that he was right. He basically worked himself to death. Mm-hmm. Edison, on the other hand, his tizimeter, of course, it ended up being a flop. Who's ever heard of the tizimeter today? But Edison went on to greater things. In fact, the very day after he returned from Wyoming, he started work on the light bulb. And there are some interesting connections between his eclipse expedition and his work on the light bulb. As for Mariah Mitchell, she got a lot of very positive press for her all-female expedition to Colorado. It's obviously she did not suddenly swing open the doors of science to women. But it was the beginning of a long, hard, and many would say continuing struggle. Mm. And she most certainly in her lifetime did a lot to get women accepted into the ranks of scientists. And certainly her students and their students later on continued that. So, but the bigger effect, I mean, in some ways I've written a book about a scientific effort that didn't really pan out. There is no Vulcan. The tizimeter didn't result in anything. But the real importance, and it really is critical importance of the 1878 eclipse, was its effect on our nation, was the effect on the American public, that here was this early event for this democratic nation to rally around in terms of science, to get us excited about science, and to get us to think of ourselves as a scientific nation. And it didn't take very long, just a few more decades, before we really emerged on the global scene as the leader in science.
So beyond the novelty of this for some of us who are headed up to Idaho or Wyoming, because I'm guessing in the listening audience right now, thousands are. But beyond that, are astronomers and scientists, are they seeking out eclipses? This eclipse, for example, are they looking to it for professional reasons anymore?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the questions that they're trying to answer now are on a much finer scale than the questions back in the 1800s. So back at the time of the 1878 eclipse, as I said, no one knew why the sun shined. No one knew what the solar corona was. No one really knew if Mercury was the closest planet to the sun. There were big questions they were trying to resolve. Today, it's much, much smaller questions, but still very important, and the total eclipses are still uniquely valuable. So there are a number of scientists who will be in the path of totality next Monday from Oregon to South Carolina with their telescopes and video cameras. The main thing they're looking at is the solar corona. Even though today we know that it is the sun's outer atmosphere, we know that it's extraordinarily hot, more than 1,000,000 degrees. We know that it's being accelerated into space and becomes something called the solar wind. We know it's made up of charged particles. There's still incredible mysteries. One of the biggest is, why is it so hot? It's again, it's more than 1,000,000 degrees. The surface of the sun is just thousands of degrees. It's like heat rising off a kettle that gets hotter and hotter the farther it gets from the kettle. So by studying particularly the inner reaches of the solar corona, which can still best be studied during a total eclipse, they're hoping to resolve those questions.
David, finally, how should we do this if we're headed up to see the solar eclipse? Beyond the protecting our eyes and the particulars of that, How should we experience this? What do you recommend?
Well, first of all, go.
Yeah.
Really, a 90% partial eclipse, which will be visible in much of Utah. I mean, in all of Utah, we'll see a partial eclipse of some sort, is still absolutely nothing compared with the awe-inspiring sight of totality. But if you get yourself into the path of totality and get there early because there's going to be crazy, crazy traffic, go there with just ready to experience it. Don't try to photograph it. You know, don't make this just another thing to post on Facebook. So much is going to happen in 2 minutes when it goes dark and you see sky colors like you've never seen before, and the solar corona, which is the most beautiful thing in the heavens. And look for the planets and look at the colors of the sky, because you'll see around you, not only will it be twilight overhead, it'll look like a 360-degree sunset all around you. And things will be happening fast. The temperature will drop. Bird behavior will change. The people you're with, look at how they behave. Look at how someone who you respect as an incredibly articulate person becomes a babbling idiot in the face of totality. Someone else might cry. Someone else could just be jumping up and down for joy. It's just, it's an extraordinary moment to take in with all of your senses. And go with people you love, because it's such an overwhelmingly emotional experience. You really want to share it with the most important people in your life.
You say it's a chance to wonder at ourselves.
Yes, and to remember how precious life is. I know I'm sounding now like some New Age guru, but really, it's so rare in our lives to get a stark reminder of what a miracle it is that we are alive and we're on this piece of rock that's floating in space around this our neighboring star, and we're all at the mercy of nature. And it just gives you a sense of scale in terms of space and time. It's overwhelming. I tell you, the eclipse I saw in Aruba in 1998 rewired my brain in some permanent ways that I think were very helpful ways. And a lot of people next Monday will have their brains rewired.
It's David Barron. His book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. So you might have a few questions left about the eclipse, which is coming on Monday morning. If you do, go to our website. We have a couple of links there, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.